Sassy Jack Stitchery is sponsoring this week's show with Amy Jones of Grandpa Cat. Spring is on its way, and that means the Nashville market is on the horizon. The folks at Sassy Jack Stitchery will be attending the show and hauling back a trailer full of the latest charts. Monitor the many designers who are participating in the show, make a list of the charts you want, and place your order with Kim so she can ship them to you as soon as the show is over. Be sure to place your orders as soon as you can so Kim can place her orders with the various designers. Sassy Jacks will have a shop at the Fiber Talk Needle Arts Weekend, March 21 to 23. If you're attending, and we hope you will, Kim will be happy to bring your Nashville order with her to save you shipping costs. Either way, place your order as soon as you can so you don't miss out on the latest designs. If you're someone who can never have enough scissors, check out the Golden Forge Scissors, a new offering from Sassy Jacks. They are available in red and willow green, drop forged from a single piece of steel, hand finished by Italian artisans, and are fantastic. Treat yourself to a pair today. Make it a habit to visit the Sassy Jacks website at sassyjackstitchery.com and join the Sassy Jacks Facebook group to keep up with all of the upcoming activities. Thanks to Sassy Jacks for sponsoring this week's show. And now our conversation with Amy Jones of Grandpa Cat. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
You're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for the needlework artists. Our artist this week from Australia, from Grandpa Cat, Amy Jones. Amy, welcome.
Hi.
All
Thanks for having me.
Yes. Well, you're the first one in Australia that we've talked to in quite a while, so this is fun. But, all right, Grandpa Cat as a business name. That's right up there. We've had some unique ones.
It's a funny
one. Yeah. So we need to explain what that's about.
So Grandpa Cat was my father's nickname that my niece and nephew gave him because he had a very grumpy old cat. And when I first threw in my corporate job years ago and went to art school, he was the one that was my biggest supporter and he really encouraged me to do it. So when I started up my business, I picked that name because, you know, it was a bit funny and quirky, but it sort of honored my dad, which I thought would be a nice thing to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, and we got the picture of the cat, so that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And that's, you know, that really points to, in your history of needlework and of art in general, you grew up in a very supportive very art and creative environment. What, your mother was a seamstress? I mean, you had it all right from the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I did a lot with my grandmother in the school holidays, sort of knitting, embroidery, sewing. And with my mother, she made a lot of clothes and taught me how to sew. And we used to sit and do tapestries together right throughout my childhood. And then with my dad, he was the woodworker, so I did a lot of woodwork with him as well. So there were all very lots of hobbies in our household, always lots of craft going on. So, yeah, and I was always happy to be part of it.
So you know your way around a saw too then, huh?
I do. Yeah, I do. And now my 15-year-old is really into woodwork, so we have lots of chats about that. Yeah, so it's good.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So you go to art school and is it always been art for you? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I started with a very different career. I worked in investment banking, and did that till my mid-20s. And, it was always in the back of my mind though, the art thing. And, I think I hit, how old was I? 26. And I just, to be honest, couldn't really stand it anymore doing what I was doing. So I went back to university and signed up to do, I studied fine arts and education and I majored in painting and drawing. So I'm also a qualified art teacher for high school.
Oh, okay. Okay. Did you ever teach?
I taught for about 6 years as an art high school art teacher and did my art on the side. And then after I had children, I moved from school-based teaching to teaching private workshops. And I worked for a major art gallery teaching creative workshops to adults and children for quite a long time. And now recently I've just started doing relief teaching locally, just occasionally in between exhibitions. So I'm back in schools at the moment.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm a former science teacher, and Beth homeschooled her, all of her kids. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We know the teaching routine. Yeah.
Yeah. Teaching.
I love teaching in general. Like, I just really enjoy doing classes. And I think, you know, it was a bit of a step to go back to the classroom after 15 years off. But, you know, bit of a shock to the system, but I've really enjoyed it. So it's good. And it gives me the space to still do the creative things that I want to do.
Yeah. That's interesting that you teach art in a school. And, you know, a lot of times those kinds of things will just take the energy out of your personal creative, you know, environment. But it didn't for you. You went home at night and did more.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I'm pretty prolific. I work very long hours with my art, and it's sort of a need to do it. I feel compelled, you know, and it's, I think part of the reason why I kind of was attracted to textile arts is it's very portable. And, you know, it's something I can take to the park with my children while they're playing and I'm just sitting there stitching. You know, I'm there at school pickup sometimes holding something, working on it, or standing at the kitchen bench. And when I had, quite a young family, it was a really good creative outlet. But even when I was working full time, there was always something on the go. I'm just one of those people who's always got busy hands.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I wondered how, if you go to art school and teach art, how it is that needle and thread rise above all the other options in terms of your creativity. So it's the portability, but there's got to be more to it than that. It must speak to you in some way.
I mean, initially it was just me dabbling. Like, I had a baby, you know, it was when I had my third child and I had a baby, and I was dabbling with all different things, trying to find something that would give me an outlet, a creative outlet. But, you know, obviously I was caring for, you know, a 3 months old at the time. And I did a bit of watercolor and I did some drawing and I did a bunch of different things. And Grandpa Cat was initially an illustration business. Like, I was making drawing and making greeting cards and things. And then it just gradually evolved. And I started playing a bit more with textiles. I made a few little pictures of my kids, or I stitched a bit on paintings. And I just found I really liked that tactile element. And that meditative process of just sort of stitch after stitch, and it's, you know, that repetition, but it's just the materiality as well. I fell in love with certain types of, there's a couple of types of threads that I fell in love with, and just seeking those beautiful hand-dyed silks out and wool and things like that. And I started to get more excited about them than I did about paint. So over time, it just gradually switch to be more stitching and then more and more, and then now it's all I do. So
you're in this book in Exuberance. I want to just hold it up.
You've got a copy. Lovely.
Yes. And I know that was during COVID. That was didn't that get put together during COVID?
During 2020? The art that was made for that, majority of that was done sort of 2020, 2021. So we had sort of two big lockdowns here, one that was sort of almost 6 months in 21. And so there was a lot of, we were allowed to go out for an hour, and I couldn't take my kids to the park because they weren't allowed on the playground equipment. And this sounds morbid, but we used to go to a cemetery. There's a really old cemetery. It's not in use anymore, but it's got a huge overgrown trees and stuff, and it's really beautiful. And we went there for our 1 hour walk, And while the kids were sort of climbing the trees, I'd be taking photos and just sort of looking at the way the light came through the canopies and all that sort of thing. And just looking at, there was all these overgrown pathways sort of making, you know, defined ways. And I think at that time, like, we all were kind of feeling a bit lost and sort of trying to find our way in this weird new reality we all had. And I think that notion of pathways and tunnels and that sort of thing, that mysterious element, was what really appealed to me. And so a lot of those works were based on that particular spot. And I think partly because it was really beautiful, but it was also what was available to me at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was sort of those moments of emotion. Like, there's one in the book, Bindweed, that is sort of, the girl is curled up in the fetal position. And it was just that feeling, that fleeting feeling of, like, overwhelm, which I think a lot of people would resonate with during that time. You know, but it was a way to kind of get it out in some sort of quiet way rather than getting frustrated or angry. Yeah.
Right. So do you think that the stitching during that time helped you work through all those emotions?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, that is how I work my way through things and process feelings about things, you know, and in that particular time it was, you know, certainly isolation, it was boredom, it was frustration, it was all the things, you know, that we were all feeling back then. Yeah.
What did you do for fun as a kid? I played in a graveyard. Okay.
I know, right? Yeah.
Right.
My youngest, okay. he still asks to go there. It's pretty funny.
Oh,
we haven't been to the cemetery for a while. Like, it's got really good trees, like really big old fig trees, and they're huge, like really amazing root structures to climb and get in amongst. So it's actually a really popular spot locally for people to just go anyway and hang out. So yeah, it sounds weird when you say graveyard, though.
Yeah. I'm just thinking. Yeah. You know. I grew up. What'd you do as a kid? Never mind.
I mean, I live in Newtown, and traditionally this is an area that was full of, you know, really alternative folk, lots of goth people and things like that. So people wouldn't be too surprised about us hanging out in a graveyard here.
Oh, boy. Do you find you're trained as an artist, painting, but you choose threads? Do you find that there's an element of restriction in terms of color with threads that you don't have with paint? Or are today's range of colors and threads sufficient for what you want as an artist?
Yeah, look, I think they are sufficient. I mean, I do sometimes use a bit of paint on things if I just can't get the exact color I want. I have occasionally gone in with a tiny bit of watercolor and touched up some of the threads.
Okay.
No, I don't do it very often, but no, I buy a lot of my threads. She's an American lady, actually, from the Thread Gatherer. And she has an enormous range of silk, like gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. And I usually can find most of what I need there. And then I also buy a lot of Threadworks, also massive range of colours. And Karen Collection is the other one. But even DMC, there's like 800 colours. So you spoil for choice, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But those two, Threadworks and Thread Gatherer, that they have tons of texture too. The texture, especially if Thread Gatherer's threads are amazing.
Oh, yeah, my absolute favorite. They're so beautiful. And they're really hard to get here. I sort of have to really think about it and then get a big order because I think there's only one shop in Australia that sells them. So I usually just buy them direct from the States. But, yeah, it's... Yeah, my big indulgence when it comes to thread.
Is that an issue for you? Because the people we talk to in Europe, getting threads like we have here in the States is most difficult in Europe. Do you have them generally available in Australia, or is it the same kind of thing? You need to ship them in.
Yeah, not like you guys have. No, definitely not. I mean, we certainly, DMC is really easy to get. You can they sell it all over the place. But more the more bespoke threads, you know, there are some small embroidery shops that stock things. But you know, you do have to hunt around a bit. And because I'm quite particular about what I'm using, I tend to source them direct myself and just buy wholesale and bring a whole big box of stuff over.
Just be done
Oh,
with
so you have
it,
inventory like I do.
yeah.
I do. I've got a big giant green box and a giant blue box and whatever else. So I bring them all over because it's the only way to find exactly what I want in the quantities that I need.
Yeah, inventory. We keep trying to get Beth to show us her basement because it's become legendary.
Not seeing my
Look,
basement.
I've exceeded my probably possible usage, I think, for my lifetime with my fabric collection. So yeah, thread's getting up there as well.
Talking about fabrics, so you collect vintage fabrics, so to do your needlework on, or
So
do
I
you collect them
collect.
to add to?
I've got a bit of both. So I do collect vintage fabrics. So I've got a lot of kimono silk that I use for applique projects and things like that. And those are the things that I used to use to make birds. And I used to make 3D birds into mobiles and hang them all over the place. And so I still got a lot of that. And so I use that for applique projects. And then I collect a lot of vintage doilies. Sort of hand, like I look for things that are damaged, that aren't really useful in their original state, and then try and repair them or find some other way to use them. So sometimes I cut out the flowers and put them on things, or I use the fabric and fix the fabric. So I've done a couple of big ones. I think one of the images I sent to you was a piece for, it was the International Textiles Biennale, and it was an old tea towel, and it was literally disintegrating while I stitched on it. It was so fragile, this thing. So I was patching it and repairing it, embroidering over the top of it. And initially it was just playing around, but it became this huge project. And it ended up taking months to finish, where I embellished the entire cloth.
Talk about your approach to art, because it's most interesting. Like, what was it? All the Flowers Sing, and it's like I got the impression in the research that I was doing that it just kind of comes out of you. It's just in you, and it you.
That would be accurate, definitely. Like I with the abstract ones especially, it's often a particular thread that will get it started. Like I just really want to use that color or that thread or a particular fabric or something will start the process. And then often with those, it's gathering just scraps or leftovers, bits and pieces from other things, or that piece has lots of tiny little scraps of silk lining from kimonos. So the collection of kimonos I had, they were all quite damaged and stained, and I kind of collected the bits that could be used or repaired. And then there were often tiny little leftovers. So there's lots of little pieces in that. And then bits of broken bracelets from my daughter, random pieces of thread from different things. I've got friends that are knitters that give me leftover bits of yarn. So all of that stuff just kind of gets collected. And then I think the only real kind of thought is in or plan is just trying to keep some sort of consistency in color palette so that it's cohesive. So just I think this is where the painting training comes into it, where looking at repetition of form or just repetition of some particular color shades and things just to kind of keep it cohesive and even though it is so abstract. So that might mean, if I've got a particular color, I might just make sure I repeat it a couple of times across the artwork so that it stays like it goes together, I guess. So it's not completely random, but definitely a lot of intuition in putting it together.
Yeah. Yeah, it just in your work, you're not afraid to use anything. You're not afraid to use any stitch, any piece of material. I mean, and but you make it come together. So it's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I just, I mean, I do a lot of research on embroidery techniques. I research in particular a lot of vintage embroidery styles. But then I try and, you know, I often experiment with those stitches, but I want to find a way to turn them on their head a little bit and put them in a completely different context to the way they'd normally be used. So I do that with a lot of the 3D pieces. There's a lot of me playing around with embroidery stitches that I've seen in sort of old crewel work or something like that, just to see how you can give it a modern interpretation or a less traditional interpretation.
The when you're doing particularly those abstract pieces, is that also kind of a mental health thing for you, just an escape?
Yeah, it is. I think that particular piece, which I think I've written about in an article. So there was a period where I was suffering quite badly with some health issues, and it was a distraction from the pain that I was in. And it was during COVID times again, and I was waiting for surgery, and you know, I was in constant pain, and I couldn't do the figurative stuff that I often do because I just didn't have that attention to focus on it. But with the abstract stuff, you know, you can't really make a mistake. You know, if you don't like a stitch, you can just stitch over it and it just adds texture. So I didn't have to think about it as much, and I could just sort of get that comfort, I guess, or that soothing thing from that I get from sewing, but without having to worry about it actually looking like something, if you know what I mean. Right. But yeah, you can't make a mistake when there's just texture everywhere. So, yeah.
No, I mean, it's we've talked with so many people about the mental health aspects of needlework, and there's thousands of stories of people who've found in needlework that escape they need from difficult issues, health issues, all kinds of things. So that you're yet another one that it helped you, and it's amazing.
Definitely. Yeah, well, even I think the figurative ones too, sometimes it's just, you know, some of them are a bit sad looking, I guess, and some people, I think when I've posted some of them where, you know, there was a particular sad looking woman in the picture, I've had a couple of friends say, oh, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. It was just that moment. Like, I was sad in that moment and I got it out and now I'm good, you know.
Yeah. Well, like, right.
But, you know. Right. Just a fleeting emotion, I guess, and a way to kind of get that out in a constructive, positive way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's something about the repetitiveness of stitching that it calms, at least for me, it calms me down.
To
do the same stitch over and over again, it kind of calms those, if you're very upset or very stressed, for me, it just is like, okay, it settles me.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think I do a lot of French knots, thousands and thousands of French knots, and I get that from that as well. And seed stitch is the other one, because it's so repetitive and just so scattered and random, and you just kind of keep. And that's the one that I just sit there like on autopilot, just drift away doing that one. And that's what I use for a lot of the background stuff on all the foresty pictures. So I do the, you know, the leaves and the structured stuff when I'm feeling kind of a little bit more on top of things. And then the background is where I get that meditative aspect.
First person in 8 years who's described French knots in a positive way. Mark this down.
When I teach workshops, they are often a nemesis stitch. Yes. Lots of people really struggle with them, but I love them.
Yep. Yeah.
I like doing them too. I mean, I don't know if I'd call them meditative, but I do like making them because if they come out, they just look so beautiful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they add such a nice texture. And if you add, like if you're doing some of the thicker threads, instead of just, you know, a lot of people tend to do them with just DMC, but if you're using something that's a little chunkier, it just adds so much texture to the piece.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. Yeah, they're great with wool. Wool's really fun for French knots. But I think, like anybody, when I was first doing them, they kind of drove me a bit nuts. But, I can't, I've probably done at least a million of them now. So I've got my rhythm down pat. I'm good.
Yeah. If you aren't good at them by now, you need to give it up. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. You're done. You're cooked. The nature, you do so much nature stuff, and it's just, it really, I found that I really connected with it. Did that all start in the graveyard? Was that kind of the original? Yeah. Which that's so
Majority of it,
weird,
yeah.
for somebody just dropping in.
It is. I did just look, I did delete all the headstones from them. Yes,
Okay.
majority of them are in the cemetery. And if they're not, so that's the Camperdown Cemetery in Newtown, which is quite a famous one in Sydney. And the other one is Rookwood, which is the other most famous cemetery in Sydney. So I also have done quite a few based on that cemetery. But I also do go to the Blue Mountains, which is a couple of hours from Sydney. My sister lives there, and it's beautiful, like a lot of Australian bush scene. So I go there a lot to collect images and do sketches. I've done a lot of pieces based on her garden. So if you could think of the quintessential Aussie bush, that's basically what you get in the Blue Mountains, birds everywhere and just lush green everywhere. And then I also go to the botanical gardens in the city. Like I'm right in the inner city, so there's, no, like we don't really have proper gardens or anything here. Everyone's got a tiny courtyard. It's very, we're all in row houses. So when I'm looking for those big lush green scenes, I have to get out of my direct surroundings to try and find them. So, yeah.
Yeah. Grandpa Cat business. How did that start? I mean, I'm shifting gears completely now.
Yeah, that's okay.
How did that start? Did you say I'm going to start a business, or was it kind of a side hustle thing that while you're raising kids, it was a way to generate a little revenue?
Yeah, it was a side hustle. And it initially started because it was just me drawing little illustrations for my kids' bedrooms. And I just thought, oh, maybe I can sell a few of these and make a little bit of money, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah.
So I think, like a lot of mums, I started up an Etsy account and thought I'd give it a go. And yeah, I sold a few bits and pieces. And I think when my second child was a baby, I drew a coloring book based on things that I thought she'd like. And so I sold a lot of those through the business as well. So it was, yeah, illustrations with cards and prints and coloring pages. So I still sell a few of those from time to time, but it's not really my focus now. What I tend to do more now is use coloring pages to create embroidery patterns instead, with that I use in my workshops. So I don't do as much of that anymore.
Yeah,
Yeah,
we've
but I did that, yeah, maybe 3 or 4 years, I think, and then I started switching back to a more intensive art practice.
yeah. And did you go right to needlework, embroidery, as from the coloring books and those kinds of things, or was
No,
there?
I mean, yeah, no, I was painting as well. I
Okay.
think taking that leap was a bit, I felt like a bit of a risk. So I had like one big show, which was like a transition period, I guess, where I had a lot of paintings, sort of 50% paintings, and then the rest was textile-based work. So they were, but thematically quite similar. But I wasn't sure how it was going to go. It's like, is anyone going to want to buy these funny little pictures that I make, or is
Yeah.
that, are people just going to think it's nuts? And some there is that kind of issue with people not necessarily taking textiles art seriously.
Right,
And
right.
I wasn't sure how it would go, but I did that show, and I sold a lot of both, and I found that people responded really well to the textiles based pieces, and that's when I thought, okay, this is a thing. Like maybe I can actually do this and not have to, make the paintings to cover my costs like I thought I would have to do. Yeah, and I found that people do that. There's a nostalgia attached to textiles work, especially embroidery, where people, it reminds them of their grandmothers or their mothers. It's, it has that cozy, heartfelt sort of feel to it. And I found that that really resonates with people. I get told a lot of stories from people when they come to my shows or when they come to the residencies and the workshops, hearing about that historical lineage of craft. And I think that's one of the things I really enjoy about doing it. And it's part of what I think so many people love about textiles is that history. And yeah, that's part of why I do it.
That's encouraging because we've talked to people for whom they run into that wall. It can't be art if it's not painting or sculpturing or illustration. It can't be art, and it needle and thread is woman's work, and so that's not art. And so,
Definitely.
but you so
Yeah.
you've not encountered that then, or at least you've not had it.
I mean, there's certainly still certain shows and exhibitions that they just, they won't accept textile-based work. But I am finding that there are more and more large art shows that are accepting textiles pieces. We have the Archibald Prize in Australia, which is a huge portraiture prize, like national prize. It's one of the biggest art prizes in Australia. And there was a piece a couple of years ago that had a significant proportion of textiles in it that actually won the Archibald, which was huge, massive. And I just think 10 years ago, I can't imagine that that would have happened. But it feels like there's been a big surge in craft-based activities and just that a great, much greater acceptance for sort of, well, traditionally feminine art forms. But yeah, I exhibit in mainstream galleries. I don't generally look specifically for textiles based galleries. Most of the work that I exhibit is in mainstream art shows next to paintings. I'm often sometimes still a little surprised that they let me in. That imposter syndrome is real, but yeah, they generally majority of the work in the shows I do is everybody else has got paintings and mine's one of the only textile works. Yeah.
But that speaks to the open-mindedness of the art community, though, that they're looking at it
Yeah.
as art instead of the technique dictating whether it's art or not.
Yeah, well, I think it's changing. And I think there is definitely a push for it, for people wanting to see more diverse types of art forms rather than just painting or, which, painting's often the holy grail of art. Like
Right,
that's
right.
the fancy, the big medium that everyone's going for. But yeah, I think the other thing that I was worried about is that, it's obviously so labor intensive that, people aren't going to buy it for anything that makes it remotely viable. But they do. People will. Like lots of people really love textile art, and I think it's worth trying to find the right audience that wants to see it and wants to have it hanging on their wall. It's worth persevering with it. Because I haven't found that, yeah, to be honest, I sell a lot more work and exhibit a lot more work now than I ever did when I was a painter.
Yeah, that's
But,
encouraging.
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
But
That's very
do you
encouraging.
do do you create your art to sell? I mean, I guess the question is, what proportion of your work is for kits and for teaching, and what is exhibition? I shouldn't, I'm not going to say quality or caliber, but aimed at exhibitions.
Yeah, no. Yeah, about 70% probably is for exhibitions.
Oh, okay.
So quite a lot. But when I do design kits and workshops, they are usually designed around the type of work that I'm doing. So I might have a particular artwork that seems to have resonated with people, and then so I'll create a smaller version of that can be done in a workshop context with a kit and whatever else. So, when I had an exhibition last year that was based on all the sort of forest scenes and mossy sort of things. So I did a workshop based on how to stitch a tree with lots of foliage. So I'll often base them around that. The moss workshops, I mean, I make and sell a lot of moss pictures, and that's still the most popular workshop that I teach and the most popular kit that I sell. And I think it's because it is, you know, for people who are really passionate about textiles, it's a really like fun way to explore different textures and experiment with different stitches that you might not otherwise use. You know, we do a lot of fancy needle weaving things and things like that. But because there's no designated endpoint to how it has to look, you know, if you make a mistake and you stuff up, you can just keep going and turn it into something else. And I think that means it's quite an approachable way to do it.
Do you have people push back on when you're teaching the class, like if they've already had formal embroidery techniques, do they get afraid?
Yes. Oh, cross stitches. Because I think, you know, you're used to a more precise method and it's very structured. And they will often come to my class because they want to try something different, but trying, like, letting go is really hard. But they, you know, people who do a lot of really traditional styles like cross stitch, for instance, they do tend to have really beautifully precise stitches. And so they'll come up with something really different to everyone else in the class with these beautiful, tiny, delicate things mixed in with some of the more textured stuff. So, but that usually that first hour or so, there's a few like, oh God, what do I do? Where do I start? Where do I start? And so I just say, well, you know, find your favorite thread. Which thread is the one that's really kind of resonating with you or is jumping out at you because you love the color or the texture? And we'll just start with that and just put some stitches on and just see how it feels. And then we go from there. And then, you know, by the end of it, it's sort of working. And, you know, and there's nothing, like, even though majority of those are fairly abstract, you know, there's nothing wrong with throwing in a few figurative things if it makes you feel more comfortable with what you're doing, you know. And I certainly do that with some of mine, you know, little leaves or flowers, or, you know, that sometimes helps people cross that boundary of not using a pattern, is if they feel like it's more familiar with some figurative elements, it's a bit easier.
Yeah. I wondered about that when I saw that. I thought, how many people get stuck on it being like free form, you know, because if you're used to it, it's fine. But if you know, we always hear people not wanting to do satin stitch or not wanting to do like some sort of surface embroidery on something because they're afraid, where do I put my needle up? I don't come up in a hole. Where do I start? Where do I go?
And, well, we kind of, when I teach classes, so I have the moss one and there's a coral one that I teach. It's similar, that has sort of probably even more color. And the way we kind of start is by, okay, we're going to choose a tricky stitch and we're just going to stitch like three or four of them. So we might do like, you know, spiderweb stitch or something into shells or something like that. So then you're starting with something that has rules, I guess. But then the stuff around it is where you go rogue and throw in whatever other elements you want to throw in. So there's usually a bit of structure in terms of that, or satin stitch in the moss classes. We often start with that and we'll do some padded satin stitch to make little pebbles. And that's sort of a grounding, like we're going, okay, we've got a few little shapes now. So we've got something started. So you've got some grounding to find where you're going to put your next thing, you know. And then I get some people who just come in and they just dive in and they just stitch like crazy all over the place from the first second, and they only put their hand up to ask me something if they can't remember how to do a certain stitch or something like that. But yeah, everybody's different, I think.
All right, but well, that's you know, that's most interesting. So that says to me that for people who have trouble getting over that hurdle, abstract is a pathway.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was a painter, I think I set myself a task of only painting abstract paintings for a year. And the reason why I did that is I did a lot of figgery stuff. I've always done lots of florally things, but I felt like my work was getting a bit too tight, too structured, too rigid in my thinking. And it's like, well, you just got to paint, like learn how to play with paint and not care as much. And so I set the task to only do abstract stuff for a year. And that was when I felt like, and then once I went back to figurative stuff, it was looser, it was more free, it was softer looking. It had lost that rigidity and that sort of need to make it perfect, I guess, because I'd gotten used to just playing. And with abstract art, any kind of abstract art, that's, you know, you've got a lot more leeway to do that because you're not trying to make it look like something. It doesn't have to look like a flower exactly, or it doesn't have to have perfect shading. There's, you know, you can break the rules, or you can experiment, you can put whatever materials you want in it, scraps of fabric, like whatever you want, because it doesn't have to look like some special end point where it looks exactly like a rose. So, you know, you can play and have some fun with it, which is great.
So do you incorporate play into your art routine still, or do you even have time? You've got three kids and a business. You know?
I would say the project of piles of unfinished experiments say that yes, I do play. I mean, I'm clearing up my studio at the moment because I've got an art market this weekend and I'm finding everything that I'm going to put in it and packing it and whatever. And I found a box and I was just like, I don't even remember making some of this stuff. Like there's just so many things like where I've played with a different idea or whatever. And I don't know. I was looking at them thinking I should do something with them. I don't know, stitch them all together maybe and make something giant. I don't know. But I think I've probably got at least 40 or 50 sort of random half finished things. So it's a bit ridiculous.
No, that's, yeah. I think that's normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's fascinating to me. Yeah. So when you do an abstract piece, do you always intentionally have a focal point or do you just let it go?
Just let it go.
Okay.
Yeah, no focal point. The only thing I do is maybe if I'm doing like a really textured area with like lots of needle weaving or something like that, then I might put, if I'm doing another one, I'll move it over a little bit so that they've each got space to breathe. So then there'll be something simpler in between them. But it's not a set in stone rule, I guess. But yeah, I do, you know, if I've got, you know, I really like cast on stitch at the moment. So, you know, but when you do it as drizzle stitch and it sticks up and it looks really cool, I feel like it needs its own little space because it's like, you know, I want it to shine. So I'll calm down some of the things around it. But other than that, not really. I just go nuts. Just put whatever I feel like in that moment.
Okay, now I got to know the details. So when you go to do something like that, do you lay out a palette of colors and or thread types? Nope, just go for it.
No, wow. Just go for it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's I've got like a working, I've often got working bags, I guess. So because I've usually got lots of projects going at once, depending, unless I have a deadline. But yeah, so I'll have like, oh, well, this is a green project. So there's just a bag full of green stuff. And then, you know, there might be, if I'm working on a colorful one, there'll be a bag full of colorful stuff. And then I just keep adding to it as I go through my stash and find other colors that I want to add. And so it just keeps evolving and changing as it goes on. And then I think there's that last 10% of finishing off or maybe 20%. Where then I open it, especially if it's big, I'll open the whole thing out and go, okay, how am I going to tie this all together and make it make sense? So, you know, I just did a giant piece. It was for the RPA Hospital, which is a big hospital in Sydney. They had have an artist residency. And that piece was, the idea was it was a collaborative memory of a garden. So as people came and spoke to me, we were talking, you know, talking about plant that had significance to them for various reasons that they might want to contribute to the piece. But because, you know, they were all very different things. So there was parsley, there was roses, there was some native bush tomatoes, Australian bush tomatoes. So there was all these sort of really disparate plants that don't make sense together. And initially I was just stitching one here and one here, like just all on all different things. And then at the end of it, it's like, okay, how do I make this make sense? Like it's got to be a coherent artwork rather than just a series of flowers randomly stitched everywhere. So that was then the opening it out and going, okay, we're going to put some foliage in here and I think, you know, some extra leaves, and I put some lobelia kind of growing amongst everything. And I looked up a lot of the Dutch masters, so paintings of big bouquets of flowers that they did in the 1700s. And a lot of those are flowers that don't make sense, like they wouldn't be in bloom at the same time. So I was like, okay, well, you know, let's reference some of those and how they tied totally different flowers and plants together. And so I sort of wove little bits of leaves and things in amongst it all to kind of turn it into a big bouquet. But there was a period in there where it was a bit of panic going, how am I going to make this work? You know, I've got a lotus here and I've got hydrangeas over there and like none of them go together. But the foliage, I think, is how I kind of managed to get it to tie in the end. Hopefully.
You had that posted on Instagram, right? And you're
yeah,
to get framed.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah, so I finished
I was just amazed.
Last week. Yeah, so that one went to the framers last week. So it's on hemp fabric that I painted with acrylic. And then the plants were literally drawn, so I did bit by bit, because each week I was at the hospital. And so I'd get different suggestions each week, and then I just gradually added them to the piece. So when I started, I had no idea what I was going to do or what plants would be suggested. So it was literally just, okay, all right, we're putting parsley in here. How am I going to do that? Now we're going to put in this particular rose, or I think there was a kangaroo paw, which is a Western Australian plant. So there was some really weird and interesting plants to try and include that, you know, some of which I'd never seen before. So it was a bit of a, yeah, it was a really interesting experiment, I guess, on how to make like a whole heap of different elements sort of somehow come together as a whole.
I was curious about that residency. Now I'm even more curious. How did that work?
So the artist in residence sits in the foyer of the hospital. And works there on site. And so, you know, you set up with some signage and some, you know, I bring some sample artwork so people have something to look at, especially in that first week when there's nothing on my fabric. And so I went in with just a bag of colours that I thought might be useful and a fabric marker. And people just came by and said, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm making an artwork for the hospital, and it's about a collective memory of a garden. So if you'd like to share any memories that you have of plants or gardens that were special to you and you'd like to contribute to the piece, you know, we can have a talk about it. And so I got lots of beautiful stories from people. That, you know, there was one lady there who was embroidering daisies on her daughter's nightgown because she's been in hospital for quite a while, and so she asked if I could add some daisies to the piece, so we added those. And there was a lovely Portuguese couple, and they only knew the plant name in Portuguese, and I'd never seen it before, and so we were doing this crazy Google search trying to find it. I'm like, oh, yep, it's that one. So that was the African star flower that we added to it. So there was lots of beautiful chats with people, and I do find whenever I'm in those sort of residencies or exhibitions where I'm actually stitching in public, lots of people come to have a chat, and it seems to be something that goes across so many different cultures and so many different backgrounds. Most, like, it's embroidery or textile based craft seems to go across the world, basically. You know, it seems to be something that's done absolutely everywhere, and so lots of people find some way to relate to it. And you know, it's a nice inviting thing that people will come and sit down and have a chat and tell you their stories about doing craft or people that they love that did craft. And then the garden connection kind of added another element to that. So, yeah, it was a really, it's the second hospital residency I've done. And, yeah, it's a really nice thing to be able to do.
That is so cool. So then you sit there in the lobby and stitch? Mm. Was it a couple times a month or how does that work?
Every week for 5 weeks. So for one day a week. And so then in between, so I'd collect the ideas and work on one flower while I was at the hospital and then take home my list. And, you know, some of them I had to look them up because I didn't know what they were or what they looked like. So, and then I did some sketches and added those to the piece, so then I'd have something to come back with the following week and work on. And then I worked on it in between as well, because, you know, that way there's more for people to see. And it was actually really nice doing it that way, because there's people who came and stopped by to check on the progress regularly, like, how's it going, did you put my flower in, where is it? So that was really nice as well. And there was one lady, she got two flowers in because she was sort of quite, you know, like, can I please have my flowers? Please have my flowers. I'm like, yeah, of course, you know, they're coming. Look, it's there. I drew it. It's coming.
But, okay, so yeah. What happens with the piece when you're now that you're done?
So it goes on loan to the hospital, I think for 3 years. So it'll just be displayed. They have a huge art collection in the hospital. So it'll be displayed somewhere within the hospital space. So the last artwork I did is in their cancer unit at Chris O'Brien Lifehouse. And so it's up there. They've got, a huge collection. So it's only on loan just because, they accumulate so much art that they can't keep them indefinitely. So at the end of that, it'll either come back to me or it'll get donated to somewhere else. We'll see what happens, what they want to do.
Our hospital, where my son had leukemia, and there had a lot of art there. That would be a neat program if there was some sort of, because when you're there a lot, and we were obviously with, to have someone who's doing art that you can interact with, I don't know, that would be very cool. That is a cool thing that they have there. That is neat.
Well, they have a whole art program where they have the art people with trolleys that go around to the patients. And they specifically do focus on people who are there for the long haul, and people who are sitting there doing chemo and need a distraction, or people who are on dialysis and things like that. And when they first asked me to do it, my parents both had long-term hospital stints, mum with cancer and my dad had renal failure. So we grew up at hospitals, hanging out in hospitals. We were there all the time. Dad was on dialysis for 22 years. So, for me, it was actually like being part of that program. When they invited me, I was actually really delighted to do it, because I do think it's really important to have positive experiences when you're in those sorts of situations, and it's just a really nice distraction, I think, to have something like that available to you.
Boy, what Absolutely. A great idea. It's a great idea. It really is.
It is.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And to connect, because we've talked about Stitch in Public days, but this interacts with the people directly. Yeah, it's a whole different approach. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, and I think there's that homely sort of nature to textiles, whereas sometimes painting, it feels a little bit removed from people.
Yeah.
But textiles, most people have someone in their family that did knitting or sewing or whatever. So it feels approachable, I think. So people are quite happy to come over and have a chat and like, well, what are you doing? What is that? Like, it's nice. It's a really nice way to engage with the community.
Boy, that's just great. Yeah. That's just a great idea. Yeah.
It is fantastic.
All right. We're about to run out of time here. So raising three kids and running a business and creating art. When do you sleep?
I get up really early, like 5. So I often do a bit in the morning, or that's when a lot of admin happens. And then kids are off to school and I stitch all day. And yeah, I'm often stitching on school pickup. Like if I've got a big exhibition, it's not uncommon for me to stitch 10 or 12 hours a day, every
Whoa.
day. So yeah, but I'm doing it while they're doing their homework. I'm there like with it in my hands. Like, yeah, what are you doing? Chatting, going through assignments, doing all the mum things, put it down, cook dinner, come back to it after dinner. So the main thing is fitting in more, I think, exercise, and things like that. Just making sure that I don't get too focused on what I'm doing because I am pretty obsessive with it. Like it's, when I've got a thing in my head, I want to get it out. So yeah, it's tricky at times, but yeah, that's I think a portable medium helps.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. Now I can never use the excuse I didn't have time today. Thanks. Wreck that. Jeez. Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah, no, I don't look, as far as looking after your neck and your back, I probably don't recommend stitching for quite as long as I do. I did
Yeah.
16 hours one day last week, and yeah, it's not a good idea.
16 hours in a day? Wow.
Yeah,
Oof.
I had a deadline, so
Clearly.
Do you use a hoop or a frame, or do you just do it in hand? Do you
I
stitch in hand?
use either hoops or I use those Q-snap frames because they on the bigger ones I find they don't leave marks on the fabric and the hoop sometimes does if you're moving it around everywhere. So for the bigger pieces I usually use the Q-snap frames. And they're a bit gentler on the silk as well, less likely to damage it.
Yeah,
Wow.
I was just thinking you might need a slate frame for some of your bigger pieces with all the textiles and beads in it, but then it's less portable.
Yes, yeah, and it's got to fit in a bag. So
Yeah.
it's got to fit in a tote bag. So yeah,
Yeah,
the
and in
smaller
the
Q-snap
pickup
frames,
line.
and then I just, yeah, exactly.
That'd be really hard, a slate frame in the pickup line. I can see you now.
Yeah.
What is she doing? It's on her steering wheel. She's stitching
Yeah.
two-handed.
She's mobile and she stitches. Get out of the way. All right, one last question. The lucky dip bundles.
Oh,
What is a lucky
those
dip
were just,
bundle?
well, they were just born out of me being at workshops and talking to some of the people there about, the insane amount of thread that I accumulate, especially when I teach workshops, because most venues it tends to be for 10 people, but DMC always comes in packs of 12. So then I always end up with a little bit extra, and it's stuff that I'm not necessarily going to use. And they're like, oh, you should do a lucky dip bundle and just, pick a color theme and do it. So that's what they are. So they're random threads that I've accumulated in a particular colorway, but, maybe some silk, maybe some DMC or whatever. And it's basically just a lucky dip. See what happens.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I think I'm gonna scrap those though, because I think people want to see them. So I'll probably just redo them with some photos just
Yeah.
because yeah.
People don't like being surprised, huh?
It's too much of a surprise.
So we got an exhibition coming up.
I've got some work in the Fisher's Ghost Art Prize currently, which is in Cap Campbelltown Arts Centre, and I've got a piece going in the next International Textiles Biennale, which will be travelling around Australia. It's going to, I think, 10 different galleries. And yeah, and then probably look for an opportunity for a solo show at some point, but I'm not sure when that will be yet. Trying to find the right venue. So yeah.
Are those fun or a lot of pressure, a solo show?
I really like creating a big body of work, where I sort of really focus on a particular theme and technique. I really enjoy that process. I think the most important thing is, this year, this last over the last year and a half, I've been in seven shows, And one was a duo, one was a solo, and then a big one, the one in Canberra. So, and it was a little bit too much. And it was only just because those were when the opportunities arose to use those particular venues. But in retrospect, way too much stitching, way too much stitching, and not enough thinking time. You know, sometimes you need time to sit and stare at things, just to kind of figure out the next steps or decide what you want to do next to it or whatever. And I didn't get that time because I was so busy, making work, and just it got a bit tedious at times. So, but yeah, next time. More space between exhibitions. Lesson
Yeah,
learned.
I can see that where you would start to lapse into stitching machine mode rather than creative
Oh
mode.
yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it takes a little bit of the joy out of it when you have looming deadlines that, you know, I mean, I think I had the duo show, I had 35 pieces in that, and then only 6 months later I had the next show, which had 44 pieces.
Holy smokes.
So, and I had to make majority of that from scratch. So, yeah,
Oh, that's a
don't
lot.
want to
That's
do
a lot.
it. It was, yeah. So, and they were all reasonable size too. Like most of them were about 45 by 45 centimeters. So, you know, a lot of stitching. Yeah.
Whoa. Whew. Yeah, I'd need some space in between those two. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
No kidding.
definitely.
Yep. Well, Amy, thank
Yeah.
you so much. Wow. What a ride. Really appreciate
Yeah,
it.
thank you.
Well, thank you. It was really nice to talk to you.
Yeah, enjoyed it. It's Grandpa Cat. Yes, Grandpa and Cat. .com.au, and she's on Instagram. Links are in the show notes. Amy, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank
My
you.
pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to everyone
Bye.
for listening.